This is the ESPNU College Football Podcast.
College Football Podcast.
Your host today, Ivan Maisel.
Hello and welcome to the ESPNU College Football Podcast. It's Tuesday, February 23rd. This is senior writer Ivan Maisel on a snowy, sleety, rainy, icky Tuesday, and I am joined from where I hope it's better weather in Pittsburgh, PA, by our good friend and college football guru, Beano Cook. How are you, Beano?
Well, it's the worst month we've ever had for snow in 1 month in the Pittsburgh area, so it's not, it's been an old-fashioned winter. Lots of snow, but it's not bad. It's dreary today, but it's the second month of the year, and it usually is dreary. It's a bad month because pitchers and catchers have reported. That's the beginning of baseball, and we wade through the season and hope to get through the season, and college football will be here.
Well, you know, where my wife is from in upstate New York, they call this Ithacating, because it's weather like this in Ithaca, and up at Hamilton College, where we have a good and faithful listener in John Wolfe. So wanted to say hello to John and hope he's dry and warm. Beano, the last couple of weeks, there's been more and more talk about expansion and more and more gossip and more theories and scoops and so forth. And there are a lot of eyes pointed in the Midwest toward the University of Texas, which when I looked at the standings this morning, I think is actually in the Big 12 conference, not the Big 11.
Yeah, I can't believe it. They said Texas is not being considered. I mean, putting Texas in the Big Ten is like making Mississippi the seventh New England state. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, it's ridiculous for the Big Ten even to think that Texas would be interested. Now, I have to believe maybe a phone call was made, but again, I just can't believe Texas ever gave serious consideration to the Big Ten. It would just be a ridiculous move on the part of Texas.
Well, when the first realignments began in the mid-90s, the Pac-10 reached out to Texas and Texas A&M, and Texas looked at it seriously, but I'm not sure they could have made the sale in the Texas legislature. And I don't know the state of Texas politics now to know that if Texas could leave the Big 12 with or without Texas A&M, with or without Texas Tech, with or without Baylor.
Yeah, the state legislators would never permit it. Baylor got in because the governor at the time, Ann Richards, insisted, and so Baylor got in. You hear rumors about the Pac-10 again, but you're right. It would never be permitted by the politicians. And Texas belongs where it is.
Well, yes.
That's the point.
And the larger issue, though, Beano, is who, you know, it sounds like what the Big Ten is considering and what we're all looking at is, we say Texas belongs where it is, but it sounds like everybody wants to completely rewrite the rules and start over. And the Big Ten wants to become more of a national conference in what has essentially been a regionalized structure. And I don't know whether that's good, bad, or indifferent, but it is certainly very different. And I think the effect it would have on so many schools, if they raid other conferences, would be enormous.
But Texas is going to stay right where it is, I would think. I mean, it makes more sense for them to join the Pac-10 because they're strong in those spring sports, baseball, track, tennis, golf, which the Big Ten schools aren't.
Right.
Yeah, and this stuff at Rutgers, a great following for Rutgers. I like Rutgers. I root for them, but they don't have a big following in New Jersey. I mean,
much less New York City.
I mean, that's ridiculous. Boston College, and they would tell you in Bristol, the people who track ratings, BC is not a big draw on television in Boston. And that was the selling point. The ACC said, well, we got Boston with Boston College. Well, they're not a big selling point. They wanted BC for one reason, not TV. They have a championship game. And that's what the Big Ten wants. Notre Dame's not going to join. We know that. The logical, and I think they would say yes, is Missouri. That's the logical team.
Well, if they stop at 12, I mean, I think they're looking very seriously at 14, and there's some people who believe they're looking at 16.
Why?
Because
they
believe they can generate more money and have a bigger footprint. This is my guess at why. You know, the truth is, I don't know because they haven't said. They can generate more money and generate enough so that when they slice the pie 14 times, the original 11 still get the same amount rather than having to, you know, that's the whole point about expansion. You want the pieces of the pie to be the same size for the original members and be able to bring in the new members.
The Big Ten has this television network.
Yes.
The casual fan's only going to watch something on that network that you can bet on. You can't bet on volleyball. You can't bet on swimming. Basketball and football you can bet on. I mean, nobody cares about it. I mean, Penn State has won 100 straight volleyball matches, if that's what you call them. And
yes.
There's some interest with the Penn State alumni, but I don't think the casual fan in Pennsylvania, who's not a Penn State alumnus, cares about the volleyball team, unless you can bet on it. TV, and I've said this before, you take away, I'm not just talking about betting with a bookie. I'm talking about all these fantasy league, all these various pools. You know, there's a pool that you put in $5 every football game in the NFL, and the team at is the first team to score 32 points as a final number of points they get wins the poll. You know, and that poll goes on forever. I mean, the one Super Bowl had 32 points, which was really ironic, but TV expanded the betting.
Yes.
That's what it expanded. I'm saying right now, if you did not have the betting, the Monday night ratings would be, for the NFL would be 30% lower. Just a fact of life.
I think at least 30%.
30%. I'm not. I just don't see it. Now, they might come up with 14 teams. I don't. Look, the main reason they want 12 is to have a championship game.
Yes.
So go with 12. And if you want to expand later, do it. And Missouri's the logical team. It's a Midwest university. They have more in common with the Big Ten teams than they do with the Big 12 teams. Big 8, that would have been different. But, you know, this expansion is to have 12 teams in a championship game. And the Big Ten has 3 sites indoors in December in the Big Ten, Indianapolis, St. Louis, and Minneapolis. They can have a game indoors. Maybe they can gamble and have it in Philadelphia sometime. But I don't understand it. It's about having a championship game. That's what it's all about.
Well, let me play devil's advocate. Is that such a bad thing?
No, I'm not saying that's bad.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, the Big Ten is, they want to compete with for the title with the Southeastern Conference and the Big 12. Well, they've had their years, but not that many. I mean, the championship teams in football are going to come from one of 3 conferences, Pac-10, Big 12, Southeast. Every so often, a few years ago when Ohio State could have played West Virginia, if they had beaten Pitt, they might have won that game, but they had to play LSU.
And expansion is not going to have any effect on whether the Big Ten can win a national championship.
That's right.
Because what ails the Big Ten is the economy. I mean, you know, the sport has shifted to the Sun Belt. The power in the sport has shifted to the Sun Belt. There are fewer jobs in the Midwest. You know, they don't call it the Rust Belt because it's cute. And because of that, there are fewer kids. There are fewer players.
And integration.
At a higher level. Of course, integration, but that's over a 40-year period. I think that there's been a change over the last 10 or 15 years, and there actually are the same number of kids playing, but I don't think there's the same number of good players playing, and because of the shifts economy. And it's a story I'm working on now and hope to have posted on the website in the next few weeks, is that very topic. So at any rate, this is going to be a long-term story, and we're going to talk about it a lot more. There are going to be a lot of rumors that continue to, leak out here, come out there. People will talk about it officially in drips and drabs, and we're going to beat it to death until the Big Ten makes a decision.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Speaking of long-term stories, Beano, that have taken years to come to fruition, the NCAA Infractions Committee held its hearing with USC over this past weekend in Tempe, Arizona. And to give an indication of the scope of the case, it was a three-day hearing. Infraction committee hearings usually take one day. The Alabama hearing in the early part of the last decade, which resulted in Alabama nearly getting the death penalty, was so convoluted and so detailed that took 2 days. This case between the Reggie Bush issue and the O.J. Mayo basketball issue took 3 days to hear. The amount of evidence was incredible. Several boxes of several large boxes full of a paper trail. I don't think any of that sounds very good for USC.
Well, you've been saying for a year, at least a year, that they're going to get hit with sanctions. Now, what do you think the sanctions will be? I think it's obviously lose scholarships.
Yeah, well, that's how the NCAA figured out about 20 years ago that the TV bans didn't hurt the school who committed the penalty, but it did hurt the school that they played who didn't commit the penalty.
That's correct. I mean, NBC would just about die if they could not do a Southern Cal Notre Dame game. If you look at Notre Dame's future home schedules, they're not very appealing.
No.
Not that many good games. You know, attractive opponents, and SC comes in here every other year, and Michigan every other year, and Michigan State. Those are attractive, but Wake Forest is on the schedule. Baylor's, I think, playing at a neutral site. I mean, they got a couple teams. Now, Utah is on the schedule. South Florida, though, I mean, if they were the only game on television, but there are a lot more games, so NBC has to be, we got to have USC, Notre Dame. So I think it's going to be scholarships. The question is how many years and how many each year.
That's
and
right.
You think it'll be severe, don't you?
I think it will be somewhere between hefty and severe, on that spectrum. I mean, I'm guessing that they'll take away, if I had to put a number on it, I'd say 15 to 18 over 3 years. And
yeah, 5 to 6 a year.
Which, took Alabama the better part of a decade to overcome. And I may be wrong. I'm just guessing.
Right.
That's my prediction. I don't think what USC did or didn't do was on the scale of Alabama. There was no, there's no previous record of at least in the short term. The Alabama case 7-8 years ago was the second case in a decade, but I think they will find a lack of institutional control, and when they do that, that's when they get mad. That's when the infractions committee gets mad.
Who's on the infractions committee?
It's usually a group of presidents and athletic directors from Division One. I'm going to double check while we're talking. I'm going to try to pull it up on the internet.
Vince, if I may jump in.
Yes.
Because your producer has.
Ah, thank you.
Each division has its own committee. The Division One committee currently has 10 members, 7 of which are members from the NCAA membership, and 3 of which are from the general public. One member of the 7 is a non-voting member of the committee.
They're bigger than the Supreme Court, my God.
That's
a very
good point.
They also have 4 staff personnel.
okay, it includes Paul D., the He's still on it now. Paul D., the former athletic director of the University of Miami, who still works there, the Conference USA Commissioner Britton Banowski, Missy Conboy, who is the in charge of women's athletics at Notre Dame, the commissioner of the MEAC, the Mideastern Athletic Conference, Dennis Thomas, and several other members. There are, as you pointed out, there are three attorneys who are not members of, who are not employed by any schools. There's two faculty athletic reps, from Temple in Oregon, and a professor from Missouri. So, at any rate,
a good committee.
It's
section.
And the people I know on that committee, Paul D. and Missy Conboy and Britton Banowski, are pretty sharp people, and I think they do take it seriously and will try to do their best in giving USC a fair shake. So,
well, they're going to get a fair shake, but they're going to get a hit.
Well, speaking of NCAA committees, Bino, the Football Rules Committee has put out its recommendations for changes for the coming season. There is an NCAA Oversight Committee on all playing rules that has to approve the changes. But the two big ones that I wanted to discuss with you, one is they want to change the way that unsportsmanlike conduct / taunting fouls are adjudicated. Right now, all those fouls are dead ball fouls, and that even if it happens on the field of play while the play is live, such as a guy high-stepping or pointing as he's going into the end zone, that penalty is not applied until the next play. The Playing Rules Committee wants to change that so that it is applied to that play. So a running back who points at the defensive back or goes into the end zone backwards or dives into the end zone and gets called for unsportsmanlike conduct, that would negate the touchdown. And I don't know whether the ball would go back to the line of scrimmage or it would be from the point at which he committed the infraction, but that's a big change.
Oh, real big change.
And what it makes me think of is when this unsportsmanlike conduct penalty originally came into play, which was in the late 1990s, it cost Syracuse a victory against Oklahoma. Syracuse scored late in the game, and the bench emptied onto the field, and Syracuse was penalized. Oklahoma got the ball near midfield and went in and scored and won. And I think if this change is approved, we're going to see the same thing. We're going to see a touchdown called back.
Because
kids are kids and they're 18 or 19 and they get excited. No matter how many times a coach tells them not to do that, they're going to do it. I mean, even a coach as disciplined as Nick Saban, who had, instilled that into his team when the defensive lineman returned the interception for a touchdown right before the half against Texas, they got a penalty and it cost them. Texas was able to take advantage of it. So at any rate, that's one penalty. The other one that I think is interesting, the other recommendation that the Playing Rules Committee is making, is that the eye black, the strips that players put under their eyes, it used to be to try to cut the sun or cut the glare. Now it's just there for decoration. And in the last few years, players have begun using it as a message board to give a shout out to their homeboys by, putting down their area code the way Reggie Bush used to do, or by putting, say, a biblical verse or a biblical verse citation. Tim Tebow has done in the last few years. The Playing Rules Committee wants to end that and just have eye black be eye black with no message attached.
That's the Tebow rule. I think that's why it's put in. It's like the dunk in college basketball was the Alcindor rule.
Yes.
So this is the Tebow rule. If Tebow had put up Diet Coke under, I think they still would have put the rule in. I don't think it's because it was religious. They just did it.
Well, I think if it had been commercial speech, they would have acted a lot faster.
They would have, but this gave them... Absolutely, they would have.
Yeah.
But this gave them this what did it. That's a T-ball rule. Nobody's going to tell me otherwise.
Well, I won't even attempt to. I did want to bring up a few letters. The discussion we had in the last podcast, Beano, about the origin of the little brown jug, we were guessing as to,
You were.
I'm sorry?
You were guessing.
Yeah, you're right. It wasn't you.
You're going to get the beep from Jay.
Well, we said we weren't sure. We weren't sure, and we got several emails correcting me.
Ivan and Beano, you're wrong.
Boy, Jay is tough. From Mark Churchill came in, and he explained that the 1903 game between Michigan and Minnesota, Fielding Yost, the Michigan coach, thought that Minnesota would contaminate his team's drinking water. So he asked the team manager to go down to the local general store and buy a jug. Minnesota scored a touchdown late in the game with rain clouds overhead of the 20,000 people in attendance. When Minnesota scored to tie the game, the fans rushed the field, and Yost was worried for his team's safety, so he just got off the field and they left the jug there. When Yost wrote a letter to Minnesota and asked for them to return the jug, the Minnesota athletic director, J.L. Cook, wrote back and said that Michigan would have to win the jug back.
They came into the greatest trophy in college sports by accident.
Total accident.
Yes, great.
Yes.
Well, the best things in life are by accident. They just happen. You can plan for a lot of things, but the little brown jug is the one. I was 8, 9 years old, I knew about it. I didn't know about all those other ones they have. There were some other ones, but the little brown jug, and they had a song, as you said, Glenn Miller.
Glenn Miller.
That's who it was.
Well, Mark also pointed out, Beano, that Bruce Smith's run in 1940 was not 64 yards, as you were guessing. It was 80 yards. So,
Ivan and Beano, you're wrong.
Yeah, but you have to admit it was pretty good.
Well, you were within, you were pretty close.
Yeah.
You got within 25%. That's not bad.
Remember that.
Yeah.
For some reason, that game.
So, at any rate, we got another letter, that I wanted to get to, from Germany, from a man named, Jan Weber. And he says, I enjoy your podcast over here in Flintbeck, Germany. I've been an American football fan for 25 years. And I don't miss a single podcast. You and Beano, your knowledge of football history is awesome. I got a question that is probably easy to answer. Other than Roger Staubach, were there any other former military academy players who made an impact in the NFL?
Well, we talked about Glenn Davis, but he didn't make an impact in the NFL. Bonnie Poole. No, Staubach, there might be somebody, but I don't know who it would
be. Napoleon McCallum had some good years with Oakland after being a star at
Navy.
Like
Staubach.
Not like Staubach, no.
I mean, he won 2 Super Bowls. Staubach, I would say, is the most famous academy player in the NFL, I would think. But if we're wrong, we would get an email. There's somebody out there we forgot.
Oh, yeah, there is, and I'm sure somebody, we will be told.
Send it to Ivan, because I don't have email.
And finally, from Patrick, I'm going to guess this is pronounced Latch. He said, I listened to your podcast recently and learned that Drew Brees is the third Purdue quarterback to win a Super Bowl. Sean Payton became the second Eastern Illinois University quarterback to win a Super Bowl as a head coach. Mike Shanahan was the first EIU quarterback to win the Super Bowl as a head coach in 1997.
I never would have known that.
Of course not. Do you know of any other school that has produced more Super Bowl winning head coaches? So we will put that out there and see if anybody knows.
Eubank played at Miami, Ohio. Didn't Paul Brown play there?
Yes, but Paul Brown never won a Super Bowl.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
That was 1964, which was his last championship.
Yeah. No, he wasn't the coach. Blanton Collier was.
Oh, good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, that's, see, I'm trying to think. Yeah, that's.
And then there was also one last email suggesting that, and this came from Patrick Hamblin, who said that he believed that I referred to Chantrell Henderson, the recruit who may or may not sign with USC, as a defensive lineman, and he is an offensive lineman. So he.
Oh, don't touch!
Ivan and Vino, you're wrong!
That was one sloppy podcast, was it not?
Ivan, don't blame me!
I didn't blame anyone. I was just saying that in general it was sloppy. Well, let's move quickly to the birthday calendar and see if I can read that correctly, Bino. Today, Benny Oosterbaan, the Michigan player in the 20s and coach in the post-war era. And
yeah, he succeeded Fritz Kreisler and won a national championship his first year in 48.
48, which means that he just missed having Bob
Chappius. Yeah,
play
Chappius,
for him.
I think Chappius last year was 47.
That is correct.
Yeah, the tailback that year, I think, was a guy by the name of Ortman, Chuck Ortman, I believe, but I'm not sure. If I'm wrong, we would get an email.
And then on the 26th, on Thursday.
It was a tailback. It was not a quarterback. It was a tailback. So it's Chappius, tailback.
Okay. All right. The 26th, Thursday, Gomer Jones, the Ohio State lineman in the 30s who went on to become head coach at Oklahoma. And
Succeeded
Bud Wilkinson and Vic Janowitz at Ohio State, the Heisman Trophy winner.
Yeah, Vic Janowitz, the big recruiting battle was between Notre Dame and Ohio State. He was from Elyria, Ohio, and he went to Ohio State, and then he signed a contract with the Pittsburgh Pirates. It was a catcher, and it was a game, and there was a pop foul ball in the second inning, and he went over and tried to get it. He dropped it, and then there was another one in the fifth inning, and then finally there was one in about the seventh or eighth inning, and it was up there, and somebody, I think when the press box yelled, call for a fair catch. But he was a heck of an athlete, Vic Janowitz.
Well, if he made the major leagues after winning the Heisman.
Yeah, the worst player in the major leagues in baseball, you have to be pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable. And then he played for the Redskins in the NFL, and I think he was in a car accident, and it cut short his career. I interviewed him for the Heisman Trophy Series back in the 90s, I guess it was. We couldn't use it because he had the drugs for cancer, and it was pretty rough. I mean, he went through a heck of a rough time before he died. He won the Heisman Trophy in his junior year, 1950, and then Woody Hayes came there in 51. They retired his number in the last couple of years at Ohio State. He was the second Ohio State player, I believe, to win the Heisman Trophy. The first was Les Horvat in 44. But he was a single-wing tailback. He was a defensive back in 49 when Ohio State won the Rose Bowl 17-14. He was a great athlete, great all-around player. And it was an honor to interview him, and I'm also sorry if we could not use the interview. But the cancer drugs made it rough. We probably shouldn't have done the interview. But great guy and great player.
Great player. February 28th, Bubba Smith, the dominant defensive lineman at Michigan State on that 66 team. Hayden Fry, the Hall of Fame coach, most prominently at Iowa, brought that program.
That's what got him the Hall of Fame.
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
He did not win 60% of his games, but he coached at Iowa and got them to the Rose Bowl. And I was on that selection committee for old-timers. And we recommended him, and I'm glad he got in.
And Ray Morrison, who had been was a coach for 35 years from 1915 into the early 1950s, most prominently at SMU and at Vanderbilt. And when he went to Vanderbilt, he left SMU after the 1934 season to return to Vanderbilt, which was his alma mater, missing, of course, SMU's national championship run in 1935. But he replaced one of the legends of the game at Vanderbilt, Dan McGugin.
Tell that story.
Well, Dan McGugin's story is one of my favorites, and he, in 1922, Vanderbilt played Michigan, and Michigan was already, as we established, with Fielding Yost, a power. And
he was a Michigan grad, correct, the coach of Vanderbilt?
Yes, McGugin. Well, he had attended Drake and Michigan.
Okay.
And this comes from Tim Cohane's book about the great coaches of the 20s and the 30s. It says, a few minutes before the kickoff, McGugin pointed out the window to a nearby military cemetery and then to the Michigan team warming up. In that cemetery sleep your grandfathers, McGugin said, and down on that field are the grandsons of the damn Yankees who put them there.
It's one of the great stories.
That's a great story, particularly because McGugin's dad had been a Union officer who had marched with Sherman through Georgia to the sea. But it was quite an effective rallying cry because the underdog Commodores tied Michigan 0-0, and that is a game that is still held and dear to the hearts of Vanderbilt fans with any sense of history at all. So that is a great story. And, Beano, we've reached the end, and I think it's fair to claim.
Yeah, we fooled him again.
We did.
Even in February, we did it.
We did, and our next podcast will be in March when spring ball has begun in earnest. It will be March 9th. Until then, for Beano Cook, this is Ivan Maisel. Thanks for downloading us.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's show. For more great podcasts, check out the Pod Center page at ESPNRadio.com.